Hello, everyone. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Passionate World Talk Radio Network, which is a subsidiary of Global Media Network, LLC. Passionate World Talk Radio Network's mantra is educate, enlighten, and entertain. Folks, when I tell you I am blessed, I am grateful to be a host of Chatting with Betsy, to provide you with resources, to talk to wonderful people like my guest today. I am serious. How I wish I knew about resources when I was a caregiver for my husband, Matt. And today's guest, you're just going to love her. And I'll tell you right now, if I knew about this book was around 14 years ago, I would have ran to my phone and I would have ordered it. Because I'm going to tell you, folks, I'm a baby boomer. As baby boomers are aging, we're going to need caregivers, or you're going to be a caregiver. You're going to want to listen to my guest today. And even young people are caregivers. My son Josh was a caregiver for his grandma at the age of 15 and for his dad at the age of 25 or 26. So this show is even for young people because young people are now being caregivers. Well, with me today, and you can tell I'm excited, is Dr. Deborah Greenhut. She's a Jersey girl, and I love to promote my Jersey gals. She is a lifelong family caregiver. She was a caregiver three times, a keynote speaker, educator, podcast guest, professional, and executive life coach. She also... her professional life alternated between university teaching and corporate training. She is passionate about sharing her experiences to help other caregivers. Deborah graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Middlebury College and holds a PhD from Rutgers. Dr. Deborah Greenhut is author and writer of two books. One, her first one, is the bestseller, The Hoarder's Wife, a novel. And I just want to, I always recommend, go on the guest website because Deborah does a reading from her book, The Hoarder's Wife. And I'll tell you what, you're going to want to buy that book because that book is sounds very interesting. And also an Amazon bestseller. I love the title of this book. And if I was a caregiver, I'd run out and buy it. The Rational Caregiver, How to Protect the Quality of Your Life While Taking Care of Other People. Love, love that title. I want to welcome you, Dr. Deborah Greenhut, to Chatting with Betsy.
Thank you, Betsy. It's really a pleasure to be here. I appreciate all that beautiful introduction. Thanks.
You are welcome. Just seeing the title, and I'll be honest, folks, I did not read the book, but just to see that title, and I tell you, I was a caregiver, and I just want, this is my own personal opinion, folks. I would rather read a book by someone who has lived it, okay, not just book knowledge, but lived it, because the people who have lived it, they do have a passion. And they do want to share their experiences, and it's coming from the heart, not from the head. And that's in my opinion. Dr. Deborah Greenhut, what motivated you to write your book, The Rational Caregiver?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a caregiver several times over, and I think the third time was the charm because I realized that there were certain patterns that kept repeating. I would take care of someone because I loved them and I cared so much about them. And funny things were happening around the family. As long as I was doing it, nobody wanted to help me. And, of course, no one was going to pay me to do it. And those were somewhat peripheral issues because the love was always overwhelming everything else and the sense of duty and so on. But I started to realize that our whole culture makes assumptions that once a person takes on caregiving for a family member, they don't need anything else. And unfortunately, that can lead to some very poor health and financial and mental health consequences for a person that are never quite resolved. In fact, I read that if you're an elder caregiver, it doesn't start then for most people. For me, it started at 45, which is the average age. But if you're in your 70s and you are an Alzheimer's and dementia caregiver, you have a 63% greater chance of dying before the person you're working for, before the person you're caring for. And that brought me up short. And I thought, wow, you know, what am I doing? What am I thinking here? And so I was still in my late 60s when I stopped doing that last caregiving assignment. And it was very painful to leave the person because I, you know, I felt a sense of love and guilt and all those things I was just talking about. And while we try to encourage in most management situations now a heart-centered enterprise, we're trying to get people to put more human feeling into being a manager. In caregiving, I think we need to do just the opposite because most of it is a heart-centered enterprise. And that leads to consequences for caregivers that are sometimes irreversible, whether they're financial or health or other types of well-being issues. So that's what motivated me to start because I saw this happening to me, and I wanted that to stop.
That is so true, Deborah. Do you want me to call you Deborah or Dr. Greenhut? What would you prefer?
Deborah's just fine, thanks.
That is so true. And as a caregiver, post-caregiver for two people, I was especially more my husband, I suffered from caregiver post-traumatic stress, which was not recognized when my mother-in-law was going through it. It's being recognized now. Do you talk about that in your book? Have you seen that in your business?
I try to use the term caregiver burden because there's really a spectrum of consequence, I think, for people. And certainly PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder is one of the more severe consequences of it. And as I mentioned, the older you are, the more likely death is the consequence. So there's a gamut of things that could happen to you, and I'm trying to stop things before they ever get to that level, to stop that process of deterioration that occurs. So I don't dwell on that, but that is one of the motivating influences of seeing what's happening to the people around me. I know it's more often women. There are, I guess, at least 60-some-odd% women who are caregivers, and they are living with terrible consequences, or they don't make it past the fate of their loved ones. So I'm watching this happen and thinking somebody really ought to start noticing this. And only the people who are living it can really speak up because, I'd say even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, many doctors and other professional caregivers weren't noticing what was happening to the family caregivers themselves. And they're often not recognized. They don't have a role. They're not considered when treatments are decided and so on. So that was the collateral problem that was also contributing to PTSD and other types of burdens that caregivers are carrying around. So I deal with that by mentioning it, but I'm trying to stop it before that ever gets started.
That is true. I have to tell you, my neurologist told me, and he had, treated Matt. His wife is a geriatric psychiatrist over at COPSA in where is it, Piscataway? Or South? Yeah, I think it's Piscataway with the Rutgers Behavioral. And he said that they're now caring or putting their attention to the family caregiver more now than the patient because it's the caregiver that really needs help and support. And I'm glad he told me that. And that was like a few years ago. So the tide is slowly changing, I feel. And, it's about time. I'd say hallelujah, because people don't realize the toll that caregiving takes on people. And I'm in a lot of different support groups, Deborah, a lot. And I have seen caregivers die during their caregiving or right after. And or in extreme cases, I know of one man who committed suicide. And you're right. This has to stop before anyone gets to that point. What do you recommend? What are some of the things that you recommend in your book, Deborah?
Well, I think I wanted to maybe supply a little more answer to your question, the context for me. Just to go back, I would say that caregiving was always in my blood. My dad was a physician. My mom was a nurse. And our first apartment was actually my dad's office. So in the morning, they would fold up the couch, and that would become the waiting room couch that they slept on at night. And my dad had a skeleton in the closet, a literal skeleton. So I grew up in this environment that care came first. And my parents were very good at it, and they had a very large practice that my dad sustained. My mom worked for him. And at the end of their lives, though, they decided that they could take care of themselves better than any doctor or hospital. And unfortunately, they were both very ill. My mother had emphysema and was carrying around 2 oxygen tanks. And my dad had some mental health issues and also a cardiac condition. And it was really kind of a horse race to see which one was not going to make it first. And they were 9 years apart, actually. And my mother was younger, and she died first, leaving my dad completely shocked. And I went immediately to take care of him because he was my dad, and I wouldn't have it any other way. And then I discovered that other family members weren't willing to sit with him or take some time so I could, A, take care of my mother's estate, which needed to be handled because he couldn't do it, in addition to getting him to all the 14 doctors that he had to get to. And I really couldn't figure out how my mom was doing all this before she died. It's no wonder that, you know, she just was exhausted, I think, finally.
Yes.
Couldn't make it anymore. But then two months after my mother died, I went home for one night just to see my family. I hadn't been home at all since she died. And on my way back, I just had this vague feeling. And when I got in the house, my dad was experiencing chest pains. So I had to drive him to the hospital, and on the way there, his heart literally divided in half while we were going to the hospital.
Oh, my.
So he actually died of what's called broken heart syndrome in the most literal way that you could imagine. And
I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm. It was sudden, and it was horrifying, and I suppose it was coming on. I was so busy during those 2 months that I just kept thinking, if I can do everything, he'll be okay. I can help him live, you know, 6 or 8 months like this, and then I can go back to being me. But that is not what happened there. And I think that's almost a paradigm for the way we behave around the emergency when caregiving often begins. We jump in, we're superwoman, we can do it all. And we quickly discover, and I hear this over and over, that often family members who should be able to give an hour here and there for their own parent, they're nowhere to be found. Or even relatives who might, you know, come in and at least visit with the person suddenly can't be bothered to come. So you're alone very often in the caregiving situation. And that was my model for how to do it through the other episodes. And when my partner, my last caregiving experience, developed a definite diagnosis of Alzheimer's. I had taken him to his neuropsychiatrist, and the doctor said to me, "You can't do this alone, so stop thinking of that." And that was a turning point for me. And
yes, that's
I will never forget that, the support I felt, realizing I had been just driving myself insane trying to keep up with all of the things that needed to be done for this poor man who, as the disease sets in, of course, many other functions become a problem for you. And I couldn't keep up. I was already exhausted. And unfortunately, I couldn't find anyone who wanted to help. And finally, the family agreed to hire some caregivers, but over time, this became impractical. He really developed some behaviors that needed a different level of care, let's say, more attentive and 24-hour a day care, and finally there had to be a care home for him, you know, a memory care type program, although that didn't last very long, which was very sad. But I actually had to remove myself from the situation to make all that happen, which was doubly painful and left me with tremendous feelings of guilt. So I've lived through that spectrum of emotions. I think in part I felt traumatized by a lot of it because I was so shocked that people wouldn't reach out and help me, and that some professionals, particularly my dad's story, wouldn't honor the role I was playing at all or discuss anything with me. And these experiences led me to think, there's got to be a better way. We're losing too many people on both sides of the caregiving situation because caregivers are exhausted and they can't even deliver the quality of care that's being expected of them. So I hope I answered your actual question there, but I think it's important to give a context that I came out of a caregiving background. And if anyone was ready to, you know, be 24/7, 365 woman, that was me.
Well, we have something in common, Deborah, because I worked as a licensed practical nurse, so I have caregiving background. And I can tell you, I can tell the audience, being a nurse working 8 or 10, 12-hour shifts is a whole lot easier than being with someone 24/7 and being a caregiver 24/7. It's much more difficult, and you hit on so many important points. Guilt. I haven't met a caregiver yet that did not have some kind of guilt. Mm-hmm. Some kind of guilt. I call it unjustified guilt, because we do the best we can with the knowledge we have at the time. I know I suffered from guilt, and I had no reason to feel guilty. It took me a good year to get over that. And, you know, but we're left with all these different emotions, and you're right. People don't come to help. We are abandoned. And when I used to go in my car and do videos long before COVID, I talked about caregiver abandonment, and it's a shame. Mm-hmm. Family, friends, whether it's your place of worship, abandoned. And I often think, what a beautiful ministry it would be, no matter where you worship, if people would minister to the sick. excuse me. It's just so many things. And I think before people become caregivers, they should read your book and take a course in caregiving to see if is this really what you want to do. And, you know, I think, you know, and as women, Deborah, you know, we're taught, you know, we give, and, you know, put others first. But you know what? And I say this all the time, and because I'm a Jersey girl, I'm a little blunt, self-care and putting yourself as a priority. It's not selfish. It's a matter of your life and death, literally, when it comes to taking care of yourself during caregiving. You have to take care of yourself, but how do you do that when you can't even have a break to go to the doctor? That's the problem in a lot of people's situations.
Yeah, if we're sacrificing two people at once there, it really doesn't make any sense, but a lot of people are unable to see it that way. So one thing we have to do is start changing perspective by talking about it. You had asked me what I recommend, and the framework I've put together for the rational caregiver is one that relies on management and thinking rather than that heart-centered enterprise where the feelings come first and drive all of the actions that follow. So I taught management and communication for a long time, and I thought, you know how to do all that. Why did all of that desert me just because I was taking care of a family member? And I started reading stories of other people's experiences, and I noticed that people who were involved in management actually became the care manager in their story and knew how to delegate and get other people to do things. And that's what had been missing from the three experiences I had. I couldn't seemed to set aside all those beautiful feelings I had for the person in order to get them better care. So one thing you need to do is take on that managerial persona. You can still care about your person, but what managers do is plan, lead, organize, and control. They don't do everything. So the goal is spend your energy finding other people to do things. And if it isn't your family, there are plenty of resources that go untapped because we think we don't have time to look for them. So I would say one thing that was really beneficial for me was to speak with a geriatric social worker about resources and the constraints that might come up for me. And that was so eye-opening to me. There were things I had never even thought about. If my partner had lasted 20 years with Alzheimer's, what I might have had to do or find. So having a forecast like that from someone who works in the field is tremendously helpful. I'd say get the resources you need. Find out what resources you might need, because you don't really know with any kind of disease or mental health disorder what's to come. So when you're a manager, that's what you do. You look for resources. You don't try to be the whole resource, except in not so well-run factories, let's say, where people are supervisors and workers at the same time. That's where the troubles often come in. So you want to manage to look for calm. You need to stop being superwoman or even believing that you could be. The idea is to be a manager, not superwoman. So that's number one. Your kryptonite is too much activity, and you need to accept that it has to stop. There are nice things you do for someone you care for, and then there are necessary things. So you need to start tracking your time to see where it's going. Is it going to necessary things or nice things that you want to do for the person? And some of those want-to-dos are going to have to go until or unless you can find some resources to get the other things done. So that's one thing. Another is that if you don't have any of your own personal goals when you start caregiving, and I mean goals that are separate from being the caregiver, I think you'll quickly find that that evil creature known as Carezilla will come to visit you. And he's a very angry, angry caregiver which ultimately doesn't help, and it stops you from being reasonable. So, you know, we've heard of Bridezilla, but Carezilla is lurking around.
I like that.
And that's because, you know, you're human. Your emotions are going to be out of control if you're squeezed past what you can possibly do. So we don't want her to come and make a visit for you either. I invented one last person. These are not in the book yet, or they'll probably be in the sequel, but I've been thinking about it. What is it that we confront here? And the last part of that triad would be examine your own financial health. So have your personal goals, but also what does your future look like if you do this? Many caregivers are financially ruined because we've learned that caregivers often spend between $8,000 and $20,000 of their own money to take care of someone. And it's not uncommon among couples that one person's illness wipes out the family savings and there is nothing for the other person, who may well get sick because she has been doing the caregiving and overstressed herself. So the guilty part often comes in there, but then there's no money to take care of you for the future. So if we allow these things to happen because our emotions have gotten in the way and overcome our situation, we're not being rational anymore. So it's about exerting your rational power to plan, lead, organize, and control. And I would start by looking at where your time goes. Measure your time, figure out what you're doing, and look at the want-to-dos versus the have-to-dos, so that you can see what you're actually spending time on and scale back a little bit. I'm sure you will find, if you start tracking it, that you're spending time on things that seem nice to do, where you need to be spending more time on the things that would help you to organize better, or looking up resources, or speaking with either a geriatric social worker or someone called a caregiver advocate, who might be a little less expensive, but will have a similar working list of what's available in the state. I will tell you, every day someone calls me and says, where do I start? And I ask them, excuse me, if they've called their division of aging yet in their town or their county or their state. And most have not been able to stop and think to do that, to look for it. So that's usually where we start. What's available now so you don't have to reinvent the wheel for yourself? And often those offices are the only place you need to go because they're pretty comprehensive in many places. And New Jersey, for example, has a lot of resources available to help, and senior centers and so on. So we're pretty well, we have a lot of infrastructure here. But some states where populations are spread out more and communities are much smaller, there isn't the money available to develop those kinds of databases. But states are also recognizing that all that free labor they're getting from family caregivers is contributing a lot to their GDP, but it's not contributing a lot to any of the people who are doing it. So I think there's going to be a shift in where the resources of the state are spent, because this is about to be our biggest problem. How do we take care of the caregivers so that there will be enough of them to take care of the population? Hospitals can't handle it. Nursing homes can't handle it. So we have to do something here, especially if aging in place actually takes over.
That is so true, Deborah. And I just want to tell the audience, I agree with Deborah. You know, hire a geriatric caseworker. There's geriatric nurse managers, patient advocate, caregiver patient advocate. I have interviewed several. And if you want to go look on the Passion World Talk Radio Network website and you could check out the shows, you just put in the word and a resource will come up. I did not know about resources, Deborah, in my own area, in Woodbridge Township, New Jersey. I interviewed someone who she's a death doula, but she's also an elder companion. Had I known about her and is at Colonia, and had I known about her when Matt was alive, I could have used her service, definitely. I would have hired her. And it's a shame. We don't know. It's in our own backyard. And that's one of the reasons why I'm passionate about doing the show, is to provide people with resources to help them have a better quality of life, and to help them to in their caregiving journey. And I always say, you know, education is so important. You know, planning. And I'm sure you probably came into contact with this, Deborah, with people. I know people who feel, I promised my mom and dad or my husband or my wife I would take care of them. And if I don't do it, I failed them. No, you did not fail them. Don't make promises you can't keep, because no one has a crystal ball. You don't know what's going to happen to you, or if your loved one needs more care than you were able to give. Sometimes they need more care. Sometimes they have to be in place in a facility for their own safety and for the caregiver's health. And it's not failing, and I really want people to really know and understand that, because that's a huge problem from what I see in caregiver groups. Excuse me.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there, Betsy, and even though you have some nursing background, as you mentioned, taking care of a relative is still a bit different from taking care of a patient. And as illnesses are growing more complex, we're also asking people to handle medical things at home. So unskilled people are suddenly managing IVs and changing dressings and doing things that we pay other people to do, but we don't compensate the caregivers. And that's an awful lot of service to expect from someone who hasn't signed up for this, excuse me, and suddenly is faced with all those responsibilities on top of doing all the arranging and planning and figuring out how to handle things. I was very excited that they were starting to reimburse people for doing care at home, at least at one end of the economic spectrum. That was a big help. But we also saw in the last couple of weeks that Indiana doesn't have the funds to do it anymore, so they've already stopped. So that was a very short window of support. And I'm sure other states will be experiencing the same shortfall because it costs a lot of money.
Yes, and I have to say that, you know, the Family Care Leave Act, in my situation, there wasn't enough people where I worked. I couldn't take advantage of that. My son couldn't take advantage of that either. So it was very nice that the company he worked for let him work in the morning, and then he didn't work in the afternoon. And then I worked in the afternoon. So we were a tag team. But, you know, you have your resources, your financial resources, you know, does take a big hit. I'm grateful. I'm extremely grateful, and this might sound terrible, but that's the truth. I'm glad I didn't have to place Matt because that would have hurt me financially. And I'm glad that he died before he got to that point because I know that he didn't want to be placed, but I knew I would have had to. If Matt would have lived, I would have had to have placed him. I would not have been able to take care of him, and I know that. But I'm glad that he went to his heavenly home. And it's really difficult. And this is why, Deborah, and older women, and women, statistically, we make less than men. And, you know, women take time off for caregiving or childbirth, child rearing. And you're going to find more elderly women going to have trouble being in their homes and finding places to live because of being wiped out from caregiving expenses.
Yeah, I think I'm seeing this story come up among famous people who thought they were financially secure when they said they would do caregiving. I don't know if you remember the model, Polina Pereshkova, who was married to a member of the Cars, and she agreed to take care of him. And when he died, though, she found out he had disinherited her. She was his wife. And And so she had no money, and she'd spent plenty of money to help at the time. So she's still recovering from that. She's on Instagram, and it's a fascinating story. And it's not just her story. I hear this all the time, that people do take advantage. You know, unfortunately, and I think you hit on it before, you talked about being ministries of service somewhere, that the compassion and the religious values that we're hoping will prevail here and so people will help are sometimes not there. And I remember very often I'd have someone say to me, "You're doing God's work." And I would thank them. And I would think about that, though, and I'd think, what you're really saying to me is, thank God you don't have to do it yourself.
Yeah,
you're glad.
That's right.
And I know that sounds a little bit bitter, but at the same time, I think that's true. If you're going to say you're doing God's work, why aren't you helping the other person? If you can think to say that, why not offer an hour so that person could take a shower or go, you know, just to a supermarket without having to worry about, you know, what's going on at home or how to put the person in the car. So these are the things that need to happen. It's not just governments that need to come forward, but families and friends. And I know there are many families where it works well, and there's a whole support network, and I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the situations where everybody abdicates and says, okay, that one person can handle everything, because one person cannot.
That's true. That's how families argue, and there's fights, and that's why it's, you know, so important. And I talk about this till I'm blue in the face. Making your wishes known, picking out your, you know, having power of attorney, who's going to do that. And I've talked to several people over the years. You know, as a family, there's siblings. Sometimes you're the only child, but if there's siblings, give them a job that they're great at. You know, if someone's great at finances, let them do that. Someone's good at medical, let them handle that. What do you do when your siblings don't want to help you out? I don't know. that must be really difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, the other resources become very important then, and the social worker and so on. And at least they should pay for you to have that kind of assistance to get yourself started again. If you have no one to delegate to, you need to find services outside of your family. And sometimes those are expensive. There are things that are available.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes institutionalizing someone is not the best option for people. So they do have to figure out how to do it at home. But then some of the nicer things you want to do have to go by the wayside because you really cannot do it all. And I think, you know, on the heart side of it, I'm not saying don't just be heartless and don't think about your feelings, but the first thing to know is if you're doing this at all, you are enough. And it doesn't get said enough to people, and people find it hard to embrace. We always think we're not doing enough. And frankly, you are enough if you have stepped up to take care of another human being.
Yes, that's very true. You know, and the people who criticize, of course, we'll have family members or maybe friends that will sit there and judge you and criticize you, that they won't lift a finger to help. You know what? You got to do a Jersey style or Betsy style and say, you know what? Either shut up or be of a help.
Yeah.
That's what I would tell them. I've had people say to me, oh, well, you know, especially if there's stepchildren involved, they don't like how you're taking care of their dad or their mom. You know what? Frankly, I would say, okay, I'll have them at your doorstep the next day. And good luck. It's all yours.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I would have done. Because people, and then they would wake up and realize what really is involved with caregiving. And I don't think enough people realize that, Deborah. I wish I had longer to talk to you. It's such a pleasure talking to you, Deborah. And I didn't get a chance to cover your book, The Hoarder's Wife, a novel. You're going to have to come back again. That book. Excuse me. But I want people to know about your websites, Deborah, because they're just wonderful, very informative. Could you please give your websites? I know you have two of them.
Sure. The first one is my name, so it's www.deborahgreenhut.com. And the other one, which is more focused on the recent book, is therationalcaregiver.com. So you can find me at either place, and there are contact forms there if you have questions. I'm always happy to hear from people. And I want us to solve this puzzle and make caregiving better for everyone. And that's going to take more than a village. It's really going to take – it's a global situation. The stats are the same across the world. So let's get together on this and figure out how we can make it more human and humane.
Absolutely. And where can people purchase your books?
They're both available on Amazon. So if you search for my name, Deborah Greenhut, and usually I think you have to put in The Hoarder's Wife or The Rational Caregiver, but they both should come up. If you get one, you'll be able to see information about the other two.
And which website was it where you read from The Hoarder's Wife? Was that your Deborah Greenhut website?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Folks, you got to go on there. I'd love to tell the audience, encourage the audience to visit the guest website because there's so much information on there that can't be said during 45 minutes. So definitely go on these websites. They will be in the blog and the information about Deborah. And is this how people can contact you, Deborah, is through your website?
Yes, there are contact forms there, and those will get right to me. So, and I'm pretty good about answering right away, so I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
That is great. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Folks, go on the website. It will be in the blog that Jeannie White, his station manager, writes, and Jeannie produces the show. So thank you, Jeannie, for all that you do. I want to thank Lillian Caldwell, CEO of Passionate World Talk Radio, who makes this all possible. And I want to thank you, the listeners. Thanks for listening, sharing. Please share the show with a friend. Do you know a caregiver? Recommend this book. Recommend this show and tell them about Deborah Greenhut. You know, when we keep information to ourselves that will help other people, that's being selfish, folks. I'm sorry to tell you that, but that's how I feel. And I'm not the first time I've vocalized that. To me, that is being selfish. Let's help others. Let's help others by sharing resources to help other people. That's why I'm here. That's why I do this show. And I really need your help in getting the word out so I can help as many people as possible. And I'm here to serve. That's what I'm here for. And I'm grateful to do that. Chatting with Betsy is free to subscribe to on Spotify, Spreaker, Apple, Amazon Music, to name a few. And if you're looking for a support group, I have hashtag KICK, Alzheimer's Ask Movement. And if you want to look at my personal Facebook page, it is Betsy E. Wurzel, W-U-R-Z-E-L. And you can see pictures of Josh and I. And I always post about my show, and I post about Alzheimer's. I am a Alzheimer's advocate, and I will be until the day that I cannot talk anymore. This is in my blood. I cannot walk away from it. I want people to know about Alzheimer's. I want people to learn and educate themselves about it, because there is no cure right now, folks. There's no cure. And if you have a brain, you are not immune. You can get Alzheimer's or some other dementia. And as I always say at the end of my show, in a world that you could be anything, to please be kind, shine your light bright, because we sure need it now more than ever. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Passionate World Talk Radio Network, which is a subsidiary of Global Media Network, LLC. Have a good day, everyone. Bye-bye now.